And that, of course, with Neil Diamond singing Bee, Jonathan Livingston Seagull, which is what we're going to talk about tonight. Richard Bach with us. It's an amazing story. In 1970, I picked up the classic book, just couldn't put it down. We're going to be back with Richard in a moment and talk about this and some incredible things that have happened in his life since then, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, you know, you've been hearing so much about the hacking at Target and Neiman Marcus and other retailers, and they went after data, and they got data, they got yours. Why don't you take some steps to protect yourself with Identity Guard? Identity Guard monitors your name, address, social security number, credit information. If they see any potential suspicious activity, they will promptly notify you. And why don't you take care and get a free 30-day trial of Identity Guard when you sign up at this special site, identityguard.com/George. Monitor your credit and social security number free for 30 days. Go to identityguard.com/George. That's identityguard.com/George. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Richard Bach's classic, Jonathan Livingston Seagull, is one of the few books that dominated the number one spot on the New York Times bestseller list. Now, that was for two consecutive years. Richard is a former United States Air Force fighter pilot, Air Force captain, Navy reservist as well. He continues to be an avid aviator, and he's went through some incredible situations, which we'll talk about. His latest book, Illusions 2, is an account of his angels' lessons. And here he is back on, because you're back with Ian back in 2009. Richard, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, thank you very much.
Looking forward. I've got to tell you, when I picked up Jonathan Livingston Seagull in 1970, and it was only about, 10,000 words, not a big book. I read
That's right.
I read that whole book in like one night. And, I mean, it was an inspiration. I thought it had a lot to do with astral projection, life after death. Everybody comes up with their own idea of what it was all about. When you put it together, what were you thinking about?
It was the strangest thing that I didn't think about it at all. It just suddenly happened. All of a sudden, I had a little office in this rented room, and the wall disappeared. And all of a sudden, it was like looking cinemascope. And here was this little seagull who was flying, and something said, "Well, don't just enjoy it, ride it." So I wrote as fast as I could. And somebody, whoever was running the psychic projector, they tripped off the power cord, and then the whole thing stopped. And I thought I could end it, and I couldn't do it. I had no idea what happened after little Jonathan had been thrown out of the flock. What would he do? Would he fight him? What would he do? And I couldn't. I had no idea. And so I put it away, little thing called unfinished manuscripts. And 8 years later, 5 o'clock in the morning, wham, here it was. Of course it had to happen. I came out of bed and typed as fast as I could type, and there it was.
When you submitted it, Richard, you didn't have a lot of publishers knocking down your door, did you?
Oh, you're so sweet to say it that way. I thought, a book that came this way, it had to be guided. It had to be something taking care of it. And it was, I've never had so many rejections in my life. I counted 18 rejections, and it had gone through my agent in New York, and he fortunately never told me how many times it was rejected from him. And he finally said, "I'm sorry." I was standing out by the mailbox, and there was this thing from Don Gold saying, "I'm sorry, maybe it's time to write something else." In the same mail, I had one other piece of mail there, and it was from someone I had never heard of before. And she was at a publisher, and she said, "I read some of your early books and liked them, and happened to have a manuscript that's not." Not committed to another publisher.
Oh, boy,
I just looked from one hand to the other. Did it happen? manuscript, I sure did. And I sent that thing at light speed out to her at Macmillan. And she loved it.
She got it.
People.
She understood it.
That's right. And some of the people, it had been rejected from Macmillan. And she went into the editorial meeting and she said, I want to publish this. They said, is that the one with the talking seagull, Eleanor? And she said, yes, it's about the talking seagull. So they said, okay, do it, just really cheap. So she said, okay, and that's how it happened.
Richard, to date, how many copies has Jonathan Livingston Seagull sold?
It just went through 50 million copies all around the world.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
My gosh. And then it was turned into a movie in 73.
Yeah, it was turned into a movie that I didn't particularly like.
It's hard to illustrate in a movie.
Yes, it was. And I thought that too. And I was hopeful for it, but it didn't quite work out for a number of reasons. So, in fact, Neil Diamond and me, we both had some problems with the producer and so forth. So, but fortunately, it's not a movie. It's a song. It's a book, and it touches people in vastly different ways. So, that's okay. I like that.
What does Jonathan Livingston Seagull mean to you?
What does he do?
What does he mean to you?
He said, we are creatures with enormous powers that we can, if we want to, we can learn anything. This happened to me, in fact, last year. I've had such a charmed life. I've been flying airplanes for almost 60 years. And I've been to a few airplanes, but I've never been hurt. And nobody with me has ever been hurt. And then all of a sudden, this thing
Bang.
Happened to me where my little airplane was, it was just, the wheels hit the high tension wire. And it just slammed the airplane into the floor, into the field, inverted. I didn't know that at the time. And this is what my, I become somewhat of an expert on death for this last year and a half. And my expertise depends on what I've seen. It hasn't been much, but I've learned a lot from it.
Well, you did your own Jonathan Livingston Seagull, basically.
I didn't mean to, but it turned out to be that way. Yeah,
and that was in the state of Washington where you went down,
that's
right?
Correct. Yep.
A couple years ago, August of 2012, I think.
That's right. It was just about a year and a half ago, right now.
Oh.
And it was the strangest thing in the world. Sometimes when we're given a lesson, something that we want to know, and we walk into the first lesson of it, it's just wildly, everything is different. It's wonderful. It's fascinating. And I had the same thing when I was always interested in near-death experiences and death and dying and all that kind of thing. And when it happened to me, I never saw a crash. And I was in a coma for a week, but when I came to, people said, well, you've been in a crash. I said, I wasn't in any crash. The last thing I remembered is I was just about ready to touch the ground. I could hear the tops of the grass whisking on the wheels. It was going to be a gentle touch. And they said, no, that's not true. Your wheel hit the high tension wires 40 feet above the ground, and it tripped your airplane. It just tucked right under and slammed into this pasture upside down.
Oh my God. Were you coming in to land at a small airport?
I was coming in to land at a fellow's farm field. And I didn't know there were wires there at all. I saw nothing.
Nothing there.
But all of it, here was this gentle thing. And finally, they convinced me several weeks later that I had been in a crash. And I learned a lot from that. I learned a lot from, I was concerned all my life when somebody dies and somebody gets killed, it's got to be a terrible, terrible feeling for them. Not true. It was, I felt at the beginning of this thing, I said, oh, I thought I was flying, but I'm not flying. I'm dreaming, because suddenly I was in a different place.
Right.
I said, okay, I'll see what this dream is about. Everything that I had that day about flying was gone. I just thought it was a dream. And I think the same thing is true for so many people, particularly who have violent deaths. It's not violent for them. It seems that way for us, but we see so much differently than they do. And that was an important thing for me to learn, that I've had some friends who've crashed in airplanes, and it was tough for me. And then all of a sudden I realized they didn't have that feeling at all. There was no crash, there was no fire, there were no explosions. It was a dream. It was just a dream. And when they woke up in the dream, they were in another lifetime. And
well, Richard, when you were in this coma state,
yep.
Do you remember this as a dream? I mean, what was happening when you were in the coma for all those days?
That's a wonderful question, and I don't know. For 7 days, but what it seemed to me like, I was maybe a half an hour. I was touching on this long, slow glide to touch the grass, and then all of a sudden, I couldn't see, as if somebody had put a visor, a black plastic visor, in front of my eyes.
Huh.
I couldn't see, and everything was very quiet. I said, okay, that's where I said, well, I guess I'm dreaming here. I'll just wait for part two to come along. And sure enough, after a while, the visor was gone. And I was in what I thought was a dirigible. I was floating above the land, about 1,500 feet, I guess. But nobody talked with me. I was in a room. The room had a window. And I looked down at this beautiful, beautiful land, and then there was a door in the wall, and someone had put a printed sign on it that said, "Do not open this door." Well, I'm 1,500 feet in the air. You don't have to put me.
You don't have to worry about that.
That's right, and that puzzled me for a long time, and then I finally got the idea. Had I opened the door, it would have been the end of my life here, and would have begun another life there.
What kind of injuries, Richard, did you sustain besides the coma in this accident?
There was a back. I broke some ribs. I broke something in my back.
Oh,
I had what they call a traumatic brain injury.
Single engine plane?
Oh, yeah. It was a little experimental seaplane.
Oh,
and I loved that airplane. Absolutely loved it. And I decided very early after I got conscious, I said, I'm gonna take care of it. I'm gonna heal myself. I'm gonna rebuild that airplane. And something happened during that. When you talk about this time that I don't remember the event, but I was absolutely certain that I had to rebuild Puff. That was my name for the little airplane. That was so important for me to do. And sure enough, it's been a year and a half now. And in the last 4 months, I've been flying Puff. And all this stuff that I said I had to happen has happened.
Well, I remember this, Richard, thinking back when John Denver died in a small plane crash.
Yes.
And then when yours happened and it was publicized, I mean, it was all over the country.
Yeah.
And I'm going, oh, my God. And, then we didn't hear anything about you for a long, long time. And then how long did it take for you to heal up?
Good question.
I mean, we're not talking about a long period ago. This was a year and a half ago.
As soon as I was awake, the first thing I said is, well, I have to leave here. Because I have never gotten along with hospitals. I don't know anything about
I don't like
physician.
Them.
Yeah, right. I said, well, to my ex-wife, who's a dear, dear friend, and she was waited all 7 days for me to open my eyes. And I said, well, do you have a car? And she said, yeah. I said, let's go. I want to go. She said, well, maybe. I had wires and hoses into my body and all this kind of thing. And she said, well, maybe it's not time to do it right now.
You're not going to
win. And then I said, can I call a cab? I really wanted to get out of there. But I had to stay there for 3 months. And they finally gave up on me. It was amazing how quickly you can lose your power. I couldn't walk. I couldn't stand.
I can't believe you're here now talking to us with these injuries you sustained. It's as if nothing happened to you.
And I have some thoughts about why that happened. Very, very early on, I hate the idea of being a victim of something, a crash or whatever. I don't want to be a victim. I like to be the one in charge. And I thought that right from the start. I said, if I did this, I'm going to undo it right now. I'm going to start everything I know about being a perfect expression of perfect love. That, for me, how can I say? It sounds as if it's just some kind of mantra, but what it is an affirmation of something that's really true. And I said that I don't know how many thousands of times. And Sabrina, my ex-wife, she told me too, over and over and over. No matter what the doctor said, you won't be able to walk, you won't be able to read. Oh, maybe someday, they told Sabrina, maybe someday he'll be able to read Jonathan Siegel, but he'll have no idea what it means.
Oh my gosh.
And that didn't go well with me. And well, I was terrible in the hospital. I hated the food. And they finally just said, oh, take him, get him out of here. Take him to a hospice and let him die.
You were in there for what? 3-4 months?
3 months. Yeah, I was 3 months there. And fortunately, I was so, I would have died if they would have kept me there. But fortunately, she said, no, he's not going to the hospital. He's coming home. And they changed the thing. They said, okay, all right, he's going home. And I went to home, and all of a sudden, I had all the powers that I wanted to have. I knew I could stand. And if I did it, I could do it. Sure enough, I stood. And then I tried making some steps, and I did six steps, and the last three were just exhausting. But the next day, I did 20 steps. And the day after that, I did 120.
Good for you.
I just kept working and working and working on this stuff and said, I am a perfect expression of perfect life right now. There is nothing wrong with me. I will do this and do this and do it. So I went through the whole thing. And gradually, after a while, I switched into my street clothes, and I walked in the little place where we have. I took my little Sheltie dogs for a walk, and month after month after month, and gradually I got better and better and better. And then I went back to Florida, and I shipped the airplane, what was left of the airplane, shipped it to a friend who rebuilds the airplane.
You rebuilt the plane?
Say again?
You rebuilt that plane?
I didn't, but a friend did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
He came out in Washington and looked at the hangar, and I said, oh my God, he's going to say, I can't do anything for this.
Hold on, Richard. We're at this break, but we're going to come right back. We're with Richard Bach, author of course, Jonathan Livingston Siegel. And we're with Richard Bach tonight talking about his work, Jonathan Livingston Siegel, and, of course, his near-death experience, which we'll get right into when we come back in a moment. By the way, take a moment as well and watch our television show, 10 Days Free. There's the deal for you. Just go to beyondbelief.com. And you can also look at all the other videos that are available there for you. 10 Days Free, beyondbelief.com. Welcome back. Richard Bach with us. Incredible story about how he survived a plane crash in August of 2012. And he lived to tell us about it. Richard, you're a very lucky person. You know that.
I don't know about that. It's amazing how I survived, but it was a test, because when I was in that whatever it was, dirigible or floating room or something like that, I didn't see anybody, but I heard a question, and it asked three times, "Do you want to go back to your life, or do you want to stay here?" And the first time I said, "Well, boy, this is really interesting, but yeah, I'll come here sooner or later." Mm-hmm. And then they said, "Do you want to go back?" I thought, "Well, yeah, I think so." I said one more time, "Do you want to go back?" And as soon as I said yes, the whole place disappeared, and I felt as if I was way in the air and just dropping, like, right down to the ground, and all of a sudden I was in a hospital. I said, "What is this, a dream? Oh, this is another dream. Okay, I'm waking up now. Change the dream, please."
Yeah. Were you coming out of the coma right about then?
Yes. Okay. Exactly right. And I couldn't believe I was in a hospital. Why? I had this wonderful, gentle landing that turned into a dream. What am I doing in a hospital? And then she said, "Well, you had some problems here." And
just a few.
Okay. Yeah, just a few. And I realized I had to take care of those problems, whatever they were. I had to do the best that I could to affirm, to say that I'm already perfect. And I just did that over and over and over. And some people feel that there's nothing you can do with your mind that will affect your body. Not true. Just radically not true. What you think about your body is extremely powerful. And if you repeat it over and over and over, it starts to be truth for you. At least that's what I've learned.
When you wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull, it was basically in three sections, wasn't it?
That's
three parts.
That's correct.
And
it was
after your accident, you wrote a fourth section.
No, I wrote the fourth part way back there in 19 whatever it was, 67 or something like that. But I didn't print it.
Ah,
I said, come on, Richard. It's never going to be this way. You're never going to have problems with authority saying that you can do this, or religion saying you can't do it, or all that kind of thing. So I never printed it, and I put it away. And I have never kept anything for 40 years, but my ex-wife found it, and she said, "Have you seen this?" And I said, "No. What is it?" She said, "Read it." And I read it, said, "Oh my God, this thing is, it's true now. It wasn't true before, yeah, but it is now." And we'd sent that off to the publisher, and they loved it. They said, we're going to print this thing. I said, "Well, okay."
Was it somewhat Orwellian?
Well, it was... what had happened is that Jonathan had become someone who was a god, and he wasn't really a person to the other seagulls. He was somebody special, and you didn't try to fly like him. Even though he had taught students how to do that, in a few years they stopped doing it. They said, "You have to go to worship. You have to worship this Jonathan Seagull," and so things got got bad for a while, until finally some of the young birds were saying, I don't believe in Jonathan Seagull. All I want to do is just fly. And one of them had decided that this is no life, and I don't want to live this way. And about that time, all of a sudden, there was this flash. He had said, no seagull can fly more than 50 miles an hour. I've tried it, and it doesn't work. And so he was passed by this seagull and doing it, well, I don't know, 100-some miles an hour. And he was just stunned. He was just stunned. And the seagull turned around and talked with him. And so that was the beginning of a new way of thinking. And the same for us, too, that we need to have a new way of thinking. Sometimes we get caught in ways of thinking about how we live or how we should behave and all this kind of thing. But once in a while, we just stop that and say, I'm the one who's running my life. I get to make whatever I want to happen come true, even if it's really hard. If I want to sail a little boat across the ocean, all right, I'm going to learn about it. Everything's going to change because I want this to be. And in fact, I had a postcard from a guy who was in Portugal, and he had been in New York. He was an account executive in New York. And he decided, no, he wanted to sail. And he got this little tiny, I don't know, it was a 29-foot sloop, something like that. And he sailed it across the Atlantic, and he was going to go around the world. And he sent me a postcard in the middle of there saying, thanks for writing Jonathan Seagull. I never heard what happened to him, but I presume he had a pretty good life.
What do you think was the reason that so many people read that book, bought that book? What happened?
It was a whisper of our spirit of saying, you don't have to live a life that you don't like. You can change. It's going to cost you. It's going to cost you. You may not have quite the money that you had for holding a job mm-hmm. for a while, but you're going to have a very difficult but a very happy life. And some people decided, all right, that's fine. And sure enough, they had a happy life, and so many of them turned out to make a whole lot more money than they were making before because there was something that they loved. Whatever it is, if you link into what you love, and it can be advertising. If you love advertising, that's fine.
That's right.
For me, it was airplanes. I didn't know how to survive flying airplanes, and then it said, "Well, you can write about it." And yeah, I had some difficult times there. Lots of things of my little articles were rejected and that kind of thing. But after a while, just gradually, they began to sell. And then I went into books from there. And things, I wrote three books all about flying, and they did fairly well. And then I wrote Jonathan Seagull, and it didn't sell at all.
Well, I'll tell you what it did for me. Richard, it jump-started something in me that I always had, whether it was intuitiveness or, you know, belief in oneself. But after I was done reading, I was 20 years old then, and after I was done reading it, it just magnified something in me, and it just, I don't know what happened, but it just added to my entire persona. And
fantastic.
I mean, and from there I branched into other things. I needed more. I needed to read more about, you know, the subconscious mind. I needed to know more about positive thinking. I picked up a little book called The Magic of Believing by the late Claude Bristol. All these things were happening to me after I read your book. And strangely enough, I live in a couple places, and on my bookcase, back in St. Louis, I still have the book. And, you know, if I had done the interview back in St. Louis with you tonight, I would have mailed it to you to get it to sign, have you sign, which I still may do.
You can still do that, yes.
But it did.
Oh, that's answering your own question. What happens to people who read this? Something happens within them, and they say, I'm the one who's running my life, and I'm going to do it differently. And sure enough, it works.
Yeah, it does
really
work. And I have never experienced that from another book ever.
Oh.
You know, the Magic of Believing book was good for what I needed to do, but yours was just like a catalyst of life. It was just amazing.
Oh, thank you. That's wonderful.
So let's relive, if we can, the plane crash. And you were saying that you had Puff rebuilt.
Yeah.
And is it up and running again as a real plane?
Oh, yeah. Oh, she's flying. We've been flying for 4 months.
Oh, my gosh. You went right back. You're not scared?
Oh, sure. I had left the hospital. I was just trying to live again in my house. But this friend of mine who's in Florida happened to be in the area, and I said, I'll come down to the hangar. I want you to see, can this airplane be rebuilt? I really want to rebuild it. And I was kind of leaning against the airplane, and he looked all around it, and the wings were on the floor, and a lot of the wreckage was there. And so 5-7 minutes, he finally came up to where I was standing, and he said, I can do it. This will be, give me 3 months, give me 4 months. I can make her just as perfect as she was. And, oh, the weight that lifted as soon as he said that. And then I had a good friend who likes doing long trips. And I said, Jeff, can you drive this thing from Washington to Florida? He said, of course I can. Of course. So he did. And the airplane was there, and all some parts of it were just, they were just crushed as if a writer had ripped out a piece of paper from the printer and crushed it and thrown it at the waste paper basket, but it was just wrecked.
Richard, tell me that first experience when you got back in the plane, Puff, and took off for the first time after the accident.
Unbelievable. Well, before I got into my airplane, I flew with a friend who had the same kind of airplane. I said, can I still fly? I don't know whether I can fly or not. I think I can. And he said, well, let's try it. You pop in my airplane. So I did. And we taxied into the water, and wheels up, and flaps down, and boost pump on. And I said, is it okay? Can I fly? And he said, it's your airplane. Go. I pushed the throttle forward, and all of a sudden, everything I learned was right back with me. And we skimmed across the water and then up into the air. It was absolutely beautiful. So I had some time, and I took the test. It was necessary for me to take a test with an FAA instructor to say, okay, here's I know about.
You're ready to go again, yeah.
Right, and I'll fly an hour with you, and we'll land on the water, we'll land on the grass, all this kind of thing. And that was easy. I took that test, and then the next thing I did was here from Jim Ratty, who said, it's ready. Puff is ready. And then I flew with Dan, my other friend, in that little airplane down to where he was in Florida.
How about that?
And it was amazing because in front of the hangar, there was Puff. And it is so hard to tell you what that meant because I saw her laid out on the hangar, and there were parts. There was a part of the cockpit, the big heavy aluminum.
She was broken up like you were.
It had snapped right next to where my leg was. This thing had snapped, And the wing was destroyed, and the tail, all the top of the airplane, since it landed upside down, was just crushed. And then the next time I saw her, she was ready to fly. And the two guys, they cleared away. They got way far away from me so I could spend some quiet time with Puff. And I just cried. I couldn't help it.
I just cried.
It was so beautiful to see her again. And then after a while, I just walked around and walked around and walked around that beautiful, beautiful airplane. And I couldn't believe that everything was new again. And then in an hour, I slipped into that cockpit. And Dan got in his little airplane. And we taxied out there and got ready for a formation takeoff. I was on the right. He was the leader in the front.
It's amazing. I mean, the fact that you came back and Puff, the plane, came back. I mean, it's just so amazing. It really is.
It was my whole life. That's all of that was absolutely essential. Something happened. And I wrote a book called Travels with Puff, and it was I gave the manuscript the day before the crash. I didn't realize there was going to be a crash, but I finished the manuscript and gave it to the publisher. And that story was about flying from the Atlantic to the Pacific in this little tiny airplane with Dan, and all the things that happened was interesting stuff. And then I learned, oddly enough, I've had 41 airplanes in my life.
41? Wow.
Oh yeah. I've loved airplanes. And some of them were, there was never a word. Others would whisper a little bit. but after a while, I talked with this little airplane all the time. And so a lot of the conversations we had are in that book. And so when she was dead, when her body was dead, her spirit wasn't touched.
I was going to say, this plane is alive, Richard.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And some people say, how can that be? It's a machine. It's made out of aluminum and rubber tires and rivets. And I said, well, hey, what about your body? It's bone and it's blood. We're the same thing. You can read in a physiology book. You can read everything about all the parts of yourself, but what about your spirit? What does it say about your spirit? And sure enough, that was true for me. And so I had some just wonderful things. And one of the things that Puff said to me was, "When you get my body built, give me a lot of time because it's going to be immortal. It's not going to know how to talk." And sure enough, I flew 5 flights with her without a word. You'd think, well, hey, the talking really was inside of my mind.
Right.
Why didn't it happen? But on the fifth flight, right near the end of it, I was taking off from a lake, and she said, hi.
She was ready. She was ready. Richard, stay with us. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back more. We're going to take some phone calls with you, too. Richard Bach with us. He's the author, of course, of the classical best-selling Jonathan Livingston Seagull. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.